Hello and welcome to the Stork and I podcast for solo parents and those considering solo parenthood by donor conception. I'm your host, Mel Johnson, the solo parenthood coach and solo mum to my five-year-old daughter. Series 6 of the podcast is focused on solo parenthood stories and speaking to a range of solo mums about their path to parenthood. Before we get into today's episode, did you know that I offer individual and group coaching courses? I cover those considering this path to parenthood, those who are pregnant, as well as those who are looking to thrive as solo parents and have really confident conversations with our children and also those around us. If you are interested in coaching, check out more information on thestorkandi.com/group coaching. Over on the Thriving Solo podcast this month, I got the opportunity to speak to donor-conceived Liam. You might recognise Liam from Born from the Same Stranger, the documentary that was recently shown on ITV. Liam shares his experiences of being donor-conceived and being raised from a solo parent. He talks about meeting donor siblings, as well as his desire for information about his donor. Head over to the Stork and I website for more information about how you sign up in order to listen. And now on to today's episode, where I talk to solo mum, Holly. Holly, so lovely to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
You're more than welcome. Before we kick off, do you want to give yourself a bit of an introduction?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Holly. I've got a three-year-old little girl called Remy. How I got to decide to be a solo mum was I was getting older, which is the case for a lot of us. I hadn't met, you know, a life partner or somebody that I wanted to have children with, and at the time thought that was what I wanted and what I needed, but felt really pressured by myself to find someone because I knew that I did want children and that was an absolute non-negotiable. So I sort of thought about donor conception very loosely quite a number of years before, but didn't really ever think it would get to that point and didn't really know anything about it. It was kind of in jest that I would sort of say it to friends, if I don't meet someone, that's what I'll do. But the older I got, the more it became a reality. And at the point where I sort of decided I would consider it seriously, it wasn't really an option for me, or I didn't think it was, because financially it just seemed so out of reach at that point, which was really hard to accept because I didn't know that I was ever going to get to that place. And that's why I think I was in panic, because I was like, well, I can't afford to do this, but I also don't have another option. Things changed a little bit for me in the next couple of years after that. I had a couple of promotions at work, so my salary was a lot more. I managed to buy my house, so I was in a bit of a better position that way as well. And then I really started, I think it was when I was coming up to 34 or 35, I started to really think about it seriously and look into it from a more serious side and what the options would be. Then I knew what, you know, I knew kind of what the options were. And I initially was thinking about, I'm going to save for a couple more years before I start going down that journey, because I knew the cost wise and really what I would need afterwards. I didn't know what I would need to conceive particularly, you know, you never know how that's going to go. But I knew that afterwards for childcare and things, I needed a lot of money. So I was going to save for a couple of years, but I did go for a fertility MOT to see how that was looking. And that changed my kind of how quickly I did it then. So I was told I had low AMH, and that they didn't sort of tell me I had to do it then, but they said they wouldn't wait too long. So I could have waited and it probably would have been fine, but I just decided at that point, actually, what am I waiting for? I'll work it out financially. It can be done. It's just I won't have as much savings as I wanted to. And off I went to kind of start the process, I guess, and start, or, you know, put it into action. And then it all happened really quickly.
And I think that's really good for people listening as just a prompt, if you haven't had a fertility MOT, to go and get one, because I think there's so many people I've heard saying, I've just
trying to decide, and you know, it's taken years to decide. I think that's very common.
You really don't know, do you, at that point?
No,
I'd never been pregnant before. I'd never tried to be pregnant, so I really had no idea what my fertility looked like.
Yeah. And was there anything that happened that was like the final, I'm doing this, or was it just a process over a period of time?
So yeah, I think it was the results that came from the fertility check, and I think it was how that made me feel. So I kind of, although I didn't feel as much pressure as I had been put myself on, because I knew I was going to do it, I kind of just thought, how do I make this work quicker? So I actually decided to release some equity from my house, which I was lucky that I had that. And I thought, I'm just going to do that so that I can just do it, because I didn't want to put it on the back burner for another couple of years.
Yeah.
And then in that whole time, be wondering whether it's even going to happen at the end of it. So I was lucky enough to be able to do that. And that was really what kickstarted it. And then it all just went pretty quickly after that.
And did you do IUI or IVF?
IUI. So I saw two consultants at the early stages with, you know, for the fertility checks and stuff. And the first one I saw advised me that she would suggest I went straight for IVF. But the second consultant I saw said that he didn't see any reason why IUI wouldn't work for me. He said, obviously, you know, IVF has that higher success rate, but based on, although I had lower AMH, you know, everything else was pretty good shape. So I was talking to somebody about this yesterday, actually. I just decided at that point that I wanted to try IUI. I really didn't want to put myself through IVF if I didn't necessarily need to. So I wanted to give it a go. So I didn't book like I know you can do like a three cycle package and things like that. I didn't do anything like that. I just went for one shot first. That didn't work. And then I sort of reevaluated and I thought, do I do another one? I was actually really lucky that a really good friend of mine, gifted me some money to have another go.
Oh, amazing.
Which would always be so
special.
Lucky to have that, and they're such a good friend. But so I decided that I kind of hadn't lost anything, because I wouldn't have had that money anyway. So I went for a second try, and then that was when I conceived. Remy was on my second try, so I was really lucky. I think I at that point I was thinking, if this doesn't work, then I probably will go for IVF, because I think with IUI you almost have to set yourself a limit, because you could keep going, well, with any of it, but you know, each time you're not getting any more chances out of it, I guess. So
so how old were you at that point?
So when I conceived, I was 35.
Right. And talk to me about choosing the donor sperm. How easy or difficult did you find that?
Yeah, so it's really funny, actually, because now, if I had to do it now, with all the information I've got, I think I'd find it a lot harder. But at the time, I guess I was quite naive to it, and I was looking, and I was just kind of, you know, I think I looked by myself, I narrowed it down. I wasn't being particularly fussy. I was kind of just trying to go for somebody that, initially I was looking for somebody who might look a bit like me. So all of my family are very blonde hair, blue eyes. So I was initially looking for something the same, but that seemed really quite hard to find in the sperm bank I was using anyway. It was almost impossible to find that. So I decided to actually just change that, because I thought, well, that doesn't really matter, because if I was looking for a partner, I wouldn't necessarily look for that to be the same. So the other thing that was important to me was, you know, just what they seemed like as a person. So did they seem like somebody that, on reflection, I don't know why this mattered, because I was looking for someone who might be like someone I would date. But again, if I did it now, I probably wouldn't even consider that. But that was kind of what I did at the time. So I narrowed it down to two donors. And then we had a sperm donor selection party with my closest friends.
Love it.
And I'd sort of in my head, I sort of had chosen my favourite, but I didn't tell them. So I had these two that I'd picked, and they each read, and then they each voted on which one, and they all voted on the same one that I had picked in my head, which ended up being the donor that I chose.
Oh,
so
brilliant.
Yeah.
Nice and reassuring, yes, in some ways, that people have validated your choice.
Yeah. So yeah, that was how I chose in the end.
Brilliant. And what are your thoughts on donor siblings? Is it something that you're interested in finding out about?
Yeah,
at all?
So this is a big one, and that's really sort of current at the moment. So again, I think this is really important to sort of highlight as well, is when I don't know if you were the same, but at the beginning of this process, donor siblings wasn't even something I really considered.
Exactly.
I thought I'd educated myself. I think what I'd done is I'd educated myself on what I needed to do to get pregnant and choosing a donor, but I didn't actually know enough about the implications that will have, you know. And I think that's fair to say that we'll probably all go through that naive state. And is, you know, it's been over the last few years, and I've started following people and really reading up about and, like, you know, following donor conceived people and things, that I've really started to kind of open my eyes to what all these implications are. And at first I felt really guilty about that, and I thought, my God, I didn't even consider this. I was so naive that I didn't even. But I think that's, you know, you've got to sort of get to a place where you're okay with that, as long as you're now doing what you can to educate yourself and do the best by your child, whatever you decide that might be. So I have decided that I'd like to find Remy's donor siblings. So another thing I was naive about was her donor is American, but I use the sperm bank here, and I knew he was American, but naively I just thought, again, this was me not knowing enough at the time, I thought he was an American who had donated here. So I didn't even consider the implications in America.
Right.
And it wasn't until, I don't think it's even been a year, that I started looking, that I then uncovered that he was actually a donor at an American sperm bank that was imported here. So
right.
I've actually found around 20 siblings in America.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I'm part of a group with them on Facebook. I've introduced us to them, and, you know, they've introduced themselves, and I've seen pictures of the siblings. That's as far as I've taken that for now.
All across America, is it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And what sort of age ranges, similar ages?
So I think the oldest is about 6, and then, yeah, just a range down to, I can't, the youngest is probably about a year old now.
Wow.
That's in that group, that there might be more, I don't know.
And how did you find that, Holly? How did you?
So I originally joined
Facebook group.
I don't know if you're part of one, but these kind of unofficial, because there's no official route you can go down for this. So I joined an official, unofficial group on Facebook for the sperm bank I used here. Yeah. To start tracking, and then it was seeing posts on there that I was like, oh, okay. So I asked my sperm bank which sperm bank they were affiliated to in the States, and went to them, and then they gave me information on how, I don't, did they tell me how many, I can't remember, they told me how many, but then I found this other group via the group that I was on. And it took me a really long time. I found posts on there with the same donor. So I saw a couple.
So you knew there was someone.
It took me a really long time to join the group.
Yeah.
Because I just, in all honesty, at that point, I really panicked. I didn't realise that there would be that many.
Yeah.
And I didn't actually realise there would be any in the States at that point. And I was like, oh God, I didn't even consider this. And it really hit me. It really upset me at first, actually. I took it quite hard, and then it gave me a few days to get my head around it. I was like, okay, you know, it's okay.
Yeah.
So that's as far as I've taken it with those, because I kind of see it like, because they're in the States,
yeah,
I probably won't take Remy to the States to meet them until she's old enough to tell me she wants to do that.
Yeah.
It's a big trip to do for, you know, some, like, if I did it now, she probably wouldn't even remember or understand. So it's kind of like I'm still part of the group, but that's kind of as far as it goes at the moment with those. I have found one in the UK.
Right.
There are more. I think I've had information back from the HFEA, and I think there were, including Remy, it was either 7 or 8 in total. With her being actually the second oldest, which really surprised me. I thought there'd be older ones, but so I found one in the UK. We have connected, as in me and the mum, and we've talked a bit about the kids and things like that. Her child is a year younger than Remy. They're a few hours away from us. We were hoping to meet. She's had a bit of a kind of change of heart, which I completely support. She wants to wait a little while because he's still her little boy is still that, you know, bit younger as well. So we're gonna stay connected. She said she's happy for us to exchange messages between us. It's just right now not ready to meet, which is, you know, absolutely fine. But I would like to find the others in the UK, or at least some, and start making those connections. I think Remy's quite, for a 3-year-old, she's quite switched on. Her understanding is quite advanced. So it won't be long. I don't know that she'll start asking about siblings, because I don't know if she'll understand for quite a long time that there is that, you know, there is that possibility. I'm in a solo mum group of other mums in Bristol as well. And we've talked, because I think you talked about seeing the programme on ITV, which I've watched. And that made me even more so want to do it, because I was like, this seems like the right thing to do. And we've sort of all sort of been exchanging messages over last week, actually, about, you know, our thoughts on it and terminology and stuff, because that's a really tricky one. So I feel quite unsure about using the term brother or sister at the moment, not because I know that's what they are and I'm 100% okay with that, but it's more so when you've got a 3-year-old and you tell them they've got a brother, and they see a child that they say go to nursery with who's got a brother who lives with them and is their full sibling, I think that can be quite confusing. And I don't know, that some of that is where I'm a bit stuck. I'm like, what do you do at this age, I guess?
We were talking about this on the coaching course I was running last night. And what I said is, you know, when you talk to them about being donor conceived and you say, you know, you need an egg and you need a sperm and you put it together. And the way that I say it is I use mummy's egg. And then for people who use donor eggs, you can talk about, you know, mummy's eggs were broken, and so we used an egg from a lady who was a donor. And then I say, I couldn't find anybody good enough to be your daddy, and so we used a donor to get the sperm, and then you put the egg and the sperm together to make the baby. And then when you're introducing donor siblings in, I say the donor that we use did the same thing for other people, and then we could go and meet the people who also were made from that donor. And then you don't have to label it then of what they are. You can just explain that it was other people that were made from the same donor, because it's hard, isn't it? It's hard.
They are their half brothers and sisters. And ultimately, further down the line, that's what they might decide to call them. You know, and biologically that's what they are, but at such a young age it's really hard to know what's confusing and what's not.
It is. And you need to sort of
real sticking point.
Navigate your way through it a little bit, don't you, based on your child and their understanding. And
I think that's such a big consideration when you're deciding to go down this route, is I wish somebody had told me all this stuff at the beginning, because there are so many things along the way that you have to adapt to and navigate, because that you don't expect. Or maybe as time goes on, it will become a bit easier because there's more people out there talking about it. But you know, like I said before, I didn't even consider siblings. I didn't consider that we'd ever meet these people, or, you know, any of that, or that Remy would ever want to have a relationship with them. And maybe she won't, but, you know, there's likely that she will at some point. She'll definitely want to meet them, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think I'd really like to do a bit of a plug, actually, because that documentary, so for people who don't know, Born from the Same Stranger, is on ITV. Player, and I think all of the episodes, it's on every Monday, but all of the episodes are on ITV Player to watch. And the first one, I think, has spurred a lot of people into considering about donor siblings, because it was a man raised by a solo parent who then was connected to his donor siblings, and it was just lovely to watch, wasn't it?
It was so heartwarming, wasn't it?
Incredible. Just how much they connected straight away, how similar they all looked, and it just was really special and a bit emotional actually to watch. And for me, I would love to do that for Daisy. And we have got a WhatsApp group, so for anybody who's used Manchester Fertility, there is a WhatsApp group that you can join where we share, and we have some matches, and there's a Facebook group that sits behind that. But I think for anybody who is considering finding donor siblings, there are basically Facebook groups for pretty much all of the sperm banks, aren't there? That's really the first point of call, I suppose.
Yeah.
And then last night we were also talking about some people that said they'd matched on the donor sibling registry, and so they'd paid to go onto that, and some people have matched that way as well, which
I've only just started to see talked about. Actually, I didn't know that that existed until the last couple of weeks, which I had a quick look at. I haven't joined it yet, but that's definitely out there as well. And I don't know, it's an unofficial route, I guess, but it seems to be a pretty potentially bigger database, I suppose.
I think that's definitely the biggest database, and I think a lot of people say they've had a look on there because you can look for free and haven't found anything. But you need to pay, I think, to then check if there's matches. So after our conversation last night on my coaching course and the documentary, it's inspired me to pay to just put a bit more effort into anything I can do to try to find.
It's a can of worms, but I think, you know, and everyone's got their different views on it. For me, I don't know also if it's because I know that Remy will be an only child. I'm not going to have any more children. Whether that makes it that little bit easier for me to make that decision, because somebody made a good point on one of our groups that because they're trying for a second, it makes it even that little bit more tricky, because what if the other child doesn't want to know, and the other, you know, one does but one doesn't? It's, you know, it adds a extra layer of complexity, I suppose. But Remy's quite intrigued by family, and we talk about family a lot. My guess, based on what I know of her, is that she will one day want to know who they are and meet them. So for me, it's quite important, even if it's just making the connection online for now.
And I think that's a lot of the things that I've heard, that at least you've done that work and you've set it up and it's there, and then if they want to continue and follow that up, they can, which is great.
Yeah, because I think for the donor conceived people, find that to be the burden, isn't it? It's like starting out from the beginning and having to try and do all of that themselves.
Exactly.
And I guess, you know, we're of a completely different generation of children, because, you know, these people on the programme, they're all children, well, not children, they're adults now, but they were all children that haven't had the opportunity to do any of this. And it's all been down to, like, you know, that they're of that group that wasn't able to obtain information and stuff. Whereas, you know, our children will be of that different generation, which will hopefully make things a bit easier. But it's a really, it's a minefield, and it's like you're constantly having to think, okay, what do I do about this? And you've got to take yourself out of it as well, I think, because you can't think about how you feel about it. It's like, well, how is my child gonna feel?
Exactly. That's a really good guide, I think, always, isn't it? Just trying to put yourself in the shoes.
Yeah. Sometimes it's hard, because you think, well, I don't know how I feel about this. I don't know if I want to know that information. And I don't know if I, you know, I want to see who these people are or similarities. Because, you know, Remy looks really like me and everyone says she does. But the minute you start looking at other people, you start going, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I guess it just stirs up another emotion, because you know then that your child doesn't necessarily just look like you. They do have, you know, their donor, you know, you know they do anyway, but
yeah, absolutely. And you talked, Holly, a little bit there about Remy is going to be an only child, and I've just been through this as well, in terms of, you know, finally, I've known for a long time that this is going to be the case, but sometimes it's hard to just be like, no, this is it now. And I've just been going through this massive like decluttering of Daisy's stuff, and there's everything is here. The decluttering game is huge, and it's because I think previous to this, I've not been able to part with it just in case. And now I've like said, no, this is definitely it. Then I'm going through everything. What was your sort of decision making process around that like?
So it's really funny because I actually got rid of all of her stuff as we went along, like when she was younger. Not necessarily. Well, no. So I do think I kind of decided then, but when I was pregnant, I didn't really think. I think I just knew I was gonna. I wanted that child, and that child was now coming, and that made me happy for then. So there's been a few sort of deciding factors. One being that I did find the newborn stages really hard. I didn't think, you know, I've got five nephews who I was a really big part of their life, you know, I still am, but I was when they were younger. I spent a lot of time with them, and I just, you know, I really wanted this baby. And I just thought I was going to be like this super chilled out, take to it really easy mum. That's just what I thought it would be. And it wasn't. It was really hard. And she was born in the pandemic as well. So the support network that I thought was going to be all around and all the rest of it couldn't be. So I would say really the first year I found just insane. Just, you know, there were good times, you know, and I have regrets now at how much time I spent worrying and being anxious and being stressed and stuff, because I don't really remember much about her being a newborn. So when I think about having another, I think, could I go back to that? I don't know that I with another one to look after at the same time. I also always knew that financially, to have another, I'd have to wait until she went to school because of childcare costs. I mean, that potentially could be different now with the new government funding for younger children, but I don't necessarily trust all of that anyway. But I just, yeah, so by the time she goes to school, I'll be coming up to 41. And I just don't know that, you know, people do, and it might, but I just don't know that I want another one when I'm 41. I don't know that I want to. So I had a really easy journey to conceive her, really. That might be completely different fast forward, you know, 6 years on from when I initially started going down this route. And I just don't know that I'm, one, financially in a place to potentially spend all that money, and to put myself through all of that when I could just stop her. Actually, that was quite nice and easy. And, you know, it's quite a happy memory, the pregnancy, all of it. I had a good, easy pregnancy. All of that went really straightforward. So, and really deep down, I'm happy it just being us. And when I look forward in the future at our life, I only see it as us. I don't see another child. I don't see a partner. I just see it as us. The only thing that I have a wobble about now and again is her. And I feel sad that she won't have a sibling. Like, we went on holiday last year, and I really kind of noticed that she didn't have anyone to play with, you know, around the pool. But I do think that probably gets easier as they get older, and they find it easier to integrate themselves with our kids and stuff like that. So when I break it down, I go, why would I have another? And it would only be for her. And I don't think that's enough reason. So I'm pretty 100% bang on that there won't be any more.
I think it's such an important conversation, because I think I was surprised, actually, so many people are going through this thought process. So when I shared a bit about my decision process, people were like, oh, thank you so much for sharing, because I'm trying to think it through. I think it's really, really helpful to hear other people saying, I found it really hard. And I'm totally the same, but slightly different age, actually. So the baby bit, don't get me wrong, was hard. But for me, it was like the end of two and three. Oh, I just found it so hard. And so the thought of having a baby whilst going through that, it blows my mind. I can't even imagine. And I think people who found it easier, and maybe that's us, and maybe it's our children and how they were, and like there's a lot of different factors, isn't there? Sometimes then find it easier to make the decision because they had an easier time. But then I've interviewed some people who were like, then I had no idea how hard it was going to be to have two. So I think people appreciate you sharing honestly that it was hard, or you found particular times tough, and the decision-making process that we've been through to decide not to have another. And I'm exactly the same as you that, well, it, but a slightly different situation, because I just genuinely don't think Daisy wants a sibling, which is a lucky position for me. She's never asked for a sibling. She begged me for a cat, which I've got, but she loves my undivided attention. And I just think there's she would really struggle if there was a baby on the scene.
That's another point for me as well. I mean, Remy's only three, so I'm not sure she's kind of old enough to say she wants a brother or sister. She hasn't ever said anything to this point. She does love my attention, and she's also quite a high needs child in terms of she's quite a sensitive child. She needs a lot of my support to, like, you know, when there's changes coming up or to settle her into new things, all that sort of thing. And I just know I couldn't give her that if I had, say I had a newborn now. She's just started at a new preschool, which has gone really well, but I didn't know how that was going to go. She finds lots of things really quite anxiety inducing for her age. There's quite a lot of anxiety around a lot of things, and I just know I couldn't give her the attention she needs, and then I would have such guilt. So I have based it more, you know, later as she's got older, and I've noticed that in her, I've also based it on that as well.
Exactly the same. I saw a post on Instagram this morning. I've forgotten Becky, the lady, she's called Becky, and she has loads on parenting. And she said something about children who have, I can't remember what she called it now, but it was something about big feelings. And that it just really resonated. I was like, that is exactly like Daisy. Yeah, it takes a lot of our capacity and our energy and our attention. And it would definitely impact them if we then had to try to split that with looking after a newborn. So
I'm sure they would adapt, but with it in mind that I already kind of know I don't want any more, or I just kind of think, well, that's another factor actually to say I've made the right decision.
Yeah. And I think it's just important to cover every angle, because there are plenty of people who've had two and love it, and that was the absolute right decision for them and for their child. I just think everyone is in a unique position, and we have to weigh up the options based on our circumstances that will be best for us and our child. And I hope it's reassuring for some people who are erring on possibly not going to have another one but feeling bad about it. I also listened to a really good podcast that said there is no need to feel bad about not providing a sibling for your child. Like, there's plenty of things you can put in place to make sure that that doesn't negatively impact them. So
it's things like, you don't actually know that they're going to get on as siblings either. Like, some siblings just don't, they, you know, and you might actually make things even harder for yourself by having two kids that don't actually like each other that much, or, you know, and then you've got that battle as well. So I think, you know, like you say, everyone's got to kind of do what's right for them, but I think you can make peace with it if you decide you only do want one. It's really okay, and what you can also give that child as an only child is amazing, because, you know, attention wise it makes a lot of difference for us financially and what we can, you know. I've got plans of traveling, things I want to do with Remy that wouldn't happen if I had another, because one, I'd have a young baby, so I'd have to wait even longer to be able to go and do that, and then, you know, I probably wouldn't have the money to do it and stuff like that. So yeah, I've kind of made peace in that I know what kind of life we can have as well.
And I think that's half the thing, isn't it? Like, really getting clear, what do you want from your life and almost like designing it around that and making sure that you're living, you know, your best life within, you know, what the constraints that we've got, basically, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you've talked a little bit about being a solo parent, but let's go into that a little bit more. So you found the baby stage the hardest, you were saying.
Yeah, I think that was a lot to do with my anxiety as well.
Yeah.
Particularly in the newborn first, I don't know, 8 to 12 weeks, I guess. I just wasn't the chilled out mum that I thought I was going to be, and I worried about everything, and you know, I panicked about everything she did or didn't do. And she had a lot of, you know, in hindsight I knew what it is now, she's grown out of it now, but she had a dairy allergy. She's got other allergies as well, so that probably played a part at the time that I didn't know about. And she had a lot of stomach problems, and you know, there were just some, I just remember this day where, I don't know how old she was, she was probably about 4 weeks old, I suppose, 6 weeks maybe, and she just had like days of screaming and screaming, and I called the doctors because I was like, I need to take her to the doctor, and I didn't know whether, the doctors is only down the road from us, you can walk down in, you know, 10 minutes or something, but I was like, do I walk down and she might just scream all the way in the pram? Do I get in the car? She hated her car seat, so I found driving really stressful. Do I get in the car? And then I was like, right, I'll just walk down. And I just remember charging down the road with my pram in tears, just being like, and I just walked into this doctor's room. I just remember that he went, it was during COVID times, and he had to go off and do, I don't know, maybe get, you know, suited up and whatever it was he went off to do. And I just remember sitting there crying, just being like, stop crying, because he's going to think you've absolutely lost it. But I just didn't know what to do, because she just kept crying, and I knew she was uncomfortable, and I was just, I couldn't do anything to help. And I just found everything really stressful. I found going places stressful. I couldn't get myself out of this state of panicking about, oh, I think it didn't help that it was in COVID times. There was nowhere to go and sit and feed. You couldn't sit in a coffee shop and feed them. You had to sit in your car on a cold, it was the winter as well. She was born in November. You couldn't just go anywhere and relax. Everything was, but you wanted to go out because for your sanity, you had to get out. But it was just, everything was really stressful. I just found it really, really intense. And on my own mental health, I think, in hindsight, I probably did have some, I didn't, you know, ever go to the doctor about it, but I probably did have some form of postnatal anxiety or something like that. Because, yeah, for a long time, my levels were just high. And I, even things like, I think it's because, like, the cleaning is the one thing you can control. I just got stressed all the time about my house not being as clean and tidy as I wanted it to be. And it was, looking back, it wasn't important, but it was at the time. I would be sat on the sofa feeding her, thinking, oh, that there's a muddy footprint on the floor, or that, you know, and you just look back and you go, why was I so, but you know, hormones, all of it were just played a part, but it was hard.
And I think that really resonates with me, because still to this day, like, I think it's really, again, a really useful conversation to have, that cleaning is a form of control for me, for sure. When everything else is out of control, one thing that you can easily do is try to put your house in order. And for me, there's worse things to try to control, because the result at least is that I'm very much like tidy house, tidy mind, but I know that it's a controlling thing that I'm trying to get that into control. I think it's useful for other people to hear.
Yeah,
but the downside of it, I'm the same as you. Sometimes it's hard to relax in my house, because I can't just, I'll be like playing with Daisy, and then I'll be like, but should we just tidy this bit? Do you know? And it's like, let's just play. But sometimes it's hard, isn't it? When
it's hard when you've got so many jobs in your head as well, I think.
Yeah.
You know, like, for example, on a Sunday, I love to keep our weekends for devoting my attention to her. And I don't really like doing jobs on the weekend if I can help it. But sometimes I have to, because I think, well, if I don't do it now, tomorrow I'm really busy working, I'm not going to have time to do it. But it's the build up, it's the mental load, I think, in your head that really you then find it hard to switch off from that, because you're constantly thinking, I'm sat here doing this and this is nice, but I also need to go do that, and I've got that job to, and I've got to cook the dinner, and I've got, you know, and it's all consuming, isn't it? And it's
100%.
That's the hard part. And I think that was what, in the first year, I don't know why, I think the anxiety sort of heightened it, because in the first year, in theory, I had more time because I wasn't working, because I was on mat leave. So I had more time to do things, but I didn't, because I had this all-consuming baby that needed all of my attention. But yeah, I just found it really stressful. I found myself stressed a lot. And if I look back at the first year, I was stressed a lot. Going out, I was stressed. Being in the house, I was stressed. It's so hard to, like, I really regret it. It really upsets me when I think about it, because I kind of feel like I didn't make the most of it, of that time off with her and stuff. But when you're in it at the time, you kind of need to just forgive yourself for it, because you can't, if that's how your mental state is, there's really not a lot you can do to, you just have to get by day by day, really. And we had fun times, but we probably could have had a lot more fun if I'd been a bit more relaxed.
Yeah, and I think there'll be a lot of people who are feeling that. And is there anything you would do differently, or any advice you'd give? Because I hear a lot of people say, I wish I hadn't been so stressed. But
I guess for the first part of it, I couldn't really change it, because I couldn't call on any help, because the only person I had was my mum, because she was in our bubble, and my mum works full time, so she helped me, she stayed with us for the first 6 weeks of Remy being born, but she was out at work, you know, during the day most days. I guess, like, in the time now, if I did it again now, I would 100% say, even if it's really hard for you, ask for help, because just somebody cooking you a meal, I mean, even now I celebrate when someone invites me for dinner, because I'm like, yes, please. Like, I would love someone to cook me a meal. Or so if you're in that, and, you know, because part of it, it's like you've got so much to do that you end up not looking after yourself. And if you can find, I didn't want anybody to take her. I didn't want anybody to come and, you know, if someone said to me, oh, I'll come and take her out, I didn't want them to do that, because I also didn't want to be away from her. This was the really hard part. I had a lot of anxiety about being away from her. And I was breastfeeding as well, so there wasn't really, you know, it was limited the amount of time I could be away anyway. But what I would have loved is someone to just say, I'll come and clean your house, or I'll drop you off a hot meal, or, you know, it couldn't happen at the time, but come round for dinner, you sit down and I'll cook your dinner. So if you've got help that you can ask for it. And if people are offering help, take it, because, you know, it's sometimes hard to do that and admit that you need it, but it does make such a difference.
I think I was exactly the same I didn't really want help with childcare when Daisy was a baby. Not necessarily because I had anxiety about it, but that wasn't what the problem was. I felt more lonely. I was like, come and be with me. Like, people would say, I'll come and take Daisy and give you some time on your own. I was like, I don't want time on my own. I've been on my own for every day. I want you to come and keep me company and look after me, not Daisy.
Yeah.
So it's useful for people to know that. But then what I realized is I need to tell people, I need to be more directive in terms of, because people don't know they're trying to help, aren't they? But they don't know what help you need unless you tell them.
Yeah, and I think it's so, like, it's almost like a societal norm that everyone just wants a break from their kids. Like, that's all they want. And don't get me wrong, we all love a break from our children.
Yeah.
But in, like you say, in those early days, whether it's that you don't want to be away from them, or like you say, it's loneliness, you don't always need someone to take them away. That's not always what you want. Like you say, it's help with other things, or company, or someone checking in on you just makes such a difference, doesn't it? When someone calls you. I mean, at the time, I remember every time someone did that, I used to just cry. But it was nice to know that people were checking in, and, you know, just sometimes with someone giving you a bit of a pep talk as well, and just being like, know, when you're having a day where you feel like you're doing a really bad job, someone telling you you're not, and that's what you don't get, you know. I don't for 1 minute think that every partner is going to give you this, but I was saying this the other day, even at this age now, you never get told, you know, you go out for the day, for example, and you know, your kids, maybe Daisy's that little bit older, she might be old enough to sort of say, I had a really amazing day, but you don't really get the thanks. You might go and do a wonderful thing on the weekend and your kids don't thank you, and nobody says, do you know what, you did a really good job today, like you gave Remy an amazing day today, she really enjoyed herself. Nobody says that because there's no one here to say it at the end of the day.
No, and in fact, kids have a tendency to pick up with the one thing they didn't like, either. You can get, they have an amazing day and then they're like, but that like one tiny thing, you're like, brilliant, thank you for that.
Like, thanks, So it's really nice, I think, when someone just gives you some nice feedback and you're like, okay, yeah, I did do quite a good job today.
Even this weekend, one of my friends messaged me at the end of the weekend, they've been staying with me, and said, you've done so well, like, well done. You know, your house looks lovely, Daisy's doing really well, like, well done you. And even now, Daisy's like 6 next week, and I'm like, oh, thanks. You know, it's just nice to get that recognition. Yeah.
And I know sometimes I've read comments before where people can find that a bit patronising, but I genuinely don't. I love it when someone tells me that I'm doing, like you say, even if they say, like, look at Remy, she's doing amazingly at this, and that's from you giving her that, you know, and it just feels nice. And I guess I'm not, you know, naive to the fact that not all partners are going to do that, and I'm sure weeks and months go by without your partner giving you any feedback when you have got one, but you know, you hope that there would be, if you had a partner, there would be someone else to tell you sometimes what a good job you're doing. And you know, as a solo parent, there's not that much that opportunity very often that people kind of do it, and when they do it, it is really nice.
I think it can be patronizing. I think it's very much who's saying it, what relationship you've got with them, and how they say it. So but I'm like you, I'll lap it up. I'll just take it. Thanks.
Somebody tell me, please, because normally I just get, you know, it comes to dinner time and I get, this is yucky.
Well, Daisy's like, I hate your baking. I was like, brilliant, thanks for the feedback.
We had a roast with my mum yesterday, and it was just nice for someone to say, thanks, that was lovely. This is really yucky. I'm like, oh.
And how is life now? What's life like now?
So life is good now. She's 3. Her speech and language is amazing, so I think that really helps when they get to that stage where they can actually communicate exactly what is wrong or what they want. She talks quite well about her feelings as well, so she tells me if she's shy about something or if she's frustrated, or so that really helps, because if, in all honesty, before that she was a really moany child, and I struggled with that really was a trigger for me a lot. I find the incessant moaning really.
I remember seeing you say that on Instagram, and again, I just think it's so powerful to share, because so many people will be in the same situation, and I'm the same, massively triggered. It's like, do you know how good you've got it, and yet you somehow are still moaning about everything? But it's a trigger for us, and Daisy's exactly the same. It's incredible how well they can articulate themselves. I'm like, you know, I think school is very different. It helps them with talking about feelings a lot earlier, certainly for Daisy, maybe preschool. So but I think again, it's just really reassuring when someone else says, my child's moaning and it's winding me up, because if you're in that situation, you're like, oh, it's not just me.
And just the noise of it, for me, the actual sound of it just grates on me. I just find it really like, oh my god, please just stop. And she was like that as a baby as well. She was never really a crying baby. She was, you know, when she was tiny, but as she got older, she didn't cry a lot, but she moaned a lot, and I just found it really grating. And now it's a relief, because she's, don't get me wrong, she still moans now, but not to that extent. She can tell, and you know if she starts moaning now, I can say to her, tell me in your words what's up?
Going
don't
on?
you, know, you don't yeah. need to make that noise, tell me what it is. And she's really getting to a stage now where she can tell me, and that makes a huge difference. So I know you mentioned this age being, and it might change, like, you know, every time someone says something like that, I'm like, please don't say that, because I find this age now a lot easier. And she is such good company, because she, I mean, by the time she goes to bed, I've got a headache from the non-stop chatting. But she, you know, I can have a conversation with her, and we can, you know, we talk all the time, so I'm never lonely. I've not really struggled with the lonely part anyway much. Sometimes, you know, I do, but not, I don't, not really find that a problem. But I definitely don't now, because she is, you know, from the minute she wakes up to the minute she goes to sleep, she's talking. So yeah, life now is easier. I find doing things a lot easier. So, you know, when you've got a baby, it's like all the stuff you've got to take and all the planning you've got to do to go anywhere. Whereas now at this age, it's just that bit easier to just do stuff. And, you know, when she was younger and napping and stuff, she wasn't one who would just fall asleep in a restaurant in a pushchair. Like, it was like I'd have to go home or drive around for a nap. And I just always found that part of it. She doesn't nap now, so it's like we can go anywhere, we can do anything, and it's easy. There are still times that life is hard, and but generally, I would say, you know, compared to baby age, I find this a lot easier.
And I think everyone will sort of, or most people will say it gets easier as they get older. I think for me, and it was the big feelings, the big emotions. Daisy needed a lot of support working through how to contain her emotions, and she really struggled with that. And just as she's got older now, again, she's been able to articulate it more, and we can talk it through rather than it was coming out in big meltdowns.
I think, like, another good point on that as well is you have to adapt as a parent to the child you've got, not make them the child you want them to be.
Yeah, so true.
So I was a really shy child, and I suppose I desperately don't want Remy to feel like I did as a shy child, but she is a very shy, she probably always will be. And I now tell her that's okay, because I remember always being she's so shy, and, you know, that makes you more conscious about how shy you are. Whereas now she started at a new preschool a few weeks ago, and she'll come out and she'll say, she'll talk about something, and I'll say, did you join in with that? And she said, no, I was a little bit too shy. And I say, that's okay. You'll probably feel more confident in a few weeks, and you'll want to join in, instead of saying, you know, it's silly. Because I think, you know, it's going to be part of her personality. She's probably not going to completely grow out of it. I mean, I got a lot more confident with age, but I'm nowhere near as confident even now as a lot of other people. You know, I'm an introvert, and I always will be. So I just think it's, you know, just going back to that, I think you get this idea in your head of what you want your child to be like, and or don't want them to be like, and you have to make peace with who they are.
Totally.
And that sometimes can be hard, but, you know.
Yeah.
Like you've talked about Daisy, I think they sound quite similar.
Yeah.
They need a lot of work, and that's okay. Like, I think once you get your head around that and you stop pushing against it, and you accept that you've got a sensitive child who needs this, and you then, you know, I've had to do a lot of reading and things about how I can support her.
Yeah.
And now I've got those tools and I'm using them, they are paying off.
Yes, totally agree. And the other thing for me was letting go of what other people thought. So I was like, you know, because it is when your child has big feelings and they can't contain them, and it comes out in a meltdown and an explosion, and then other people are like, oh, you know, my feeling was like, oh, why is she doing that? Why, you know? And when I could let go of that and say, this is my child and this is how she reacts, and exactly the same as you, let me learn how I can best support my child. What are the best techniques? What are the experts saying? How can I be really confident that I'm parenting her in the best way for her? that really helped, because if you compare to others, then I would look at some of my friends' children who were really compliant and well behaved and didn't have it, and it was like, oh, that would just be easy. Yeah. But then ignore that, I'm sure they've got other things that they're dealing with. Yeah. Let me just figure out how I can be the best parent in this situation, because every child's different, aren't they?
Exactly. Because I find the same with Remy. She's not really ever had the explosions and the meltdowns. She's not had that side of it, but she's just quite, she'll sort of just refuse to talk to people. So we'll go on a walk with a group of people, and I, in my head, when we're going there, I think, oh, there'll be loads of kids there, and she's gonna run around in the woods with all the kids and she's gonna have a nice time. She will just want to sit in her pushchair and not join in and not speak to anyone.
Yeah.
And it still annoys me, because I really want her to do that, and I have to just go, do you know what, maybe she's feeling anxious about this big group of kids, and I'm not going to push her. If she wants to get out of her pushchair and play, she will, but what is the point in me making her do it? And make
that's almost like the last thing you want to do, isn't it? Because I'd be exactly the same. My fairy tale version of it would be something different. But if you then start pushing your child to do something they're not comfortable with, you're just going to make it worse in the long run, aren't you? Yeah, totally agree. But it's all a learning, isn't it? You know, we don't know all of this stuff at the beginning, so you sort of have to figure it out as you're going along.
And no one tells you that you're going to have to do all this either. You just think, well, I'm just going to be a mum and we're going to like go swimming and then we're going to do this, and then when they get to this they're going to go to school, and no one says about all the things along the way that you're going to have to navigate, and that never stops. Like, you know, there's different challenges at different ages, and you know, I'm sure, you know, with Daisy at her age and going to school, there's been more stuff has come up from that. And
definitely, and I think that's part of the reason why I like to do this podcast, because I think that just hearing from other people on the just the real life challenges that they're facing, as well as the, you know, the great stuff that they're experiencing, just helps reassure you that, you know, everybody's dealing with their own different things, and the best advice is to just focus on you and your situation and how to make the best of it. And hopefully people get different things from all of the different conversations we have, and I'm sure there'll be some people listening who are like, oh yeah, I'm going through that, and it's just reassuring that you can come out the other side, and you know, it's not only you who's experiencing these things.
Definitely. And I think like talking to people about it as well just really helps, because I think like you know, you get stuck in these parent circles where you do sometimes feel vulnerable, like you say, when your child is the one doing the acting up or whatever it might be. But finding your group of people who you can just talk openly about, I think is really important as well, and that can be really hard to find, but you do find people along the way who you can just send a WhatsApp and be like, what the actual hell is this age? Like, you know, and they're having the same challenges. And you know, when you've lost your cool, and I always feel guilty, you know, on the times I have shouted, I feel horrendous afterwards. And hearing other mums or, you know, say, no, seriously, don't be hard on yourself. We've all done it.
Yeah.
You know, instead of feeling judged by people is just so important. Like, find those people you can be completely honest with, not have to keep up appearances with, and you know, pretend life is amazing all of the time, because it won't be.
I fully agree, and that's I am so passionate about this topic, particularly in helping solo parents find other solo parents, because I feel like if you find other solo parents with children a similar age to you, they just get it that little bit more. And then those WhatsApp groups can be so powerful, of your little tribe who are all like understanding, not judging, and really supporting each other. And it's just so important. And that's what I try to do in my Thriving Solo membership, connect people who and give them that, because it's such a gift, isn't it?
Yeah, it is really important,
Holly, it was so lovely chatting to you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the podcast and would like to access bonus episodes featuring donor-conceived people, psychologists and other experts, you can head over to my website, thestorkandi.com, to subscribe to the Thriving Solo membership. For $2.99 a month, you'll get access to members-only episodes, as well as the entire back catalogue. You'll get access to useful resources and a monthly community call, which are a great opportunity to meet people in a similar situation to you. On my website, you can also find more information about the coaching I offer. You can also follow me on Instagram at thestalkandi.com to get an insight into the realities of solo parent life.